breaking ball and a call. Strike three. Third strikeout for Zach.
He's going to just watch it go. A grand slam for Bryson Stott.
And there's a high fly ball. Deep right field. Harper watches it fly.
From WHYY, this is your Friday edition of Hittin' Season, a Philadelphia Phillies podcast. My name is Justin Clue. I write for Baseball Prospectus. With me is Liz Rocher, the editor of Sabres Baseball Research Journal. Hello, Liz.
Hello, Justin.
We've got Tim Jackson from Baseball Prospectus to talk about his recent article on the Phillies' deadline dreams. And Andrew Mearns, the site manager of Pinstripe Alley, is going to tell us what's wrong with the Phillies' opponent this weekend, those New York Yankees. But there's a lot going on at the moment, Elizabeth. Andrew Painter pitched six innings last night, gave up a two-run shot to Ryan Mountcastle, but it was the only hit he allowed on the night.
Ooh, I love it.
Exciting development from a pitcher who's been trying to get back on track. A Savannah Banana tried to do a backflip on CNN and wound up bouncing his face off the hard, hard ground.
Oh, no.
And a Pittsburgh sports radio personality is saying that the Phillies want to make a trade for the Pirates' O'Neill Cruz, who I love, mostly because he plays for a different team, and his various frustrations are not a part of my life. I get to just enjoy when he hits a home run into a river. He can absolutely crush the ball, but his slash line is very bad looking.
Yeah.
He strikes out a ton, not strong defensively, and he's left-handed. So beyond the team control aspect, I don't know why now would be the time to trade for O'Neill Cruz. But hey, Liz.
Yes.
You hear about this Nick Castellanos lookalike contest?
I did.
That's beautiful, beautiful stuff. Our friends at Billy Penn told us last Friday at Fringe Bar in Old City, 23 contestants. Trying to look the most like the Phillies right fielder, according to Billy Penn, each brought out their best nasty, casty swagger, celebrations, and props to sway the crowd, including unbuttoned jerseys, chains, Scooby-Doo references, and even one uncrustable sandwich. Liz, would you say that Nick Castellanos has established a record amount of lore over a couple of years in Philadelphia? You know, put aside how you feel about him as a player, he can be polarizing at times. But like all that stuff we just listed that you could use if you were trying to do an impression of him. The IF with Philly quote, all his interactions with his son's spinoff adventures as the mayor of Citizens Bank Park. All those sliding basket catches. I mean, like, is there anybody established more lore?
I don't think so. I think it definitely is him. I mean, there's the taking Kyle Schwarber to his psychedelic art installation. There is footage of him dancing to, who was it? Just Ja Rule or who was it at the at Citizens Bank Park the other night?
I don't know.
But I've seen on Reddit, like floating around, definitely a photo of Nick Castellanos just getting down, obviously having been to many Miami nightclubs and broken out those moves. I mean, he's just, he's like he allows himself to be a full human in the penetrating light of Philadelphia. And I think it's really admirable and fun that he just sort of lets himself be himself. He doesn't have like a persona that he puts on. You know, his wife is really active on social media and she is really fun. I love her.
Yeah, I mean, at the very least, he has been an entertaining player, but I know that there are people who don't hold him in very high regard because they want more and expect more. I don't know.
I
hear you. You know, you always hope to get a little more. And a guy hitting 250 who doesn't play good defense and according to some statistics, cost you a lot of runs is going to frustrate people for sure, especially when he's like, oh, yeah, the voice in his head thing where he just kind of doesn't have a strategy. He just listens to the voice in his head. That's why I'm focusing more on lore than output just for this particular question. You don't get a lookalike contest at a local bar if you're not on some level beloved. And I do think, yeah, he connected with the city in a level more than on the surface.
Absolutely. Sure. Because Bryce Harper's a guy that has a lot of lookalikes out there. I see them all the time.
Yeah.
And no one has put together a lookalike contest for him. I think largely because they realize that he would not be into it. He would think it was dumb.
He would maybe, but he would pretend to be into it because he's a professional.
Exactly. And I think that's the difference. That's like the major difference, because I feel like we know that Nick Castellanos is never pretending. He doesn't have that in him. He's like, I'm really tired. My brain is going 1,000 miles a minute. I do not have the strength to pretend that I like something I don't.
Yeah, he's the kind of guy that gets labeled an introvert when he's not really. It's just somebody who detests small talk. And on that level,
completely.
Nick Castellanos and I are entirely aligned. Yeah, I have no problem about just walking away. If all we're doing is small talk, well, this is a waste of time. Goodbye.
You are fun at weddings. Where it's literally nothing but small talk.
Yeah, I'm a hit.
At your own wedding, you walked away from multiple conversations.
Oh, yeah. I don't have time for this.
I have a wife now.
Well, one way you could look more like Nick Castellanos is if you got into a heated debate with the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred, according to Hannah Kaiser in the Bandwagon newsletter. I'm going to give you some context here, Liz. Back in May 2021, Nick Castellanos was playing for the Cincinnati Reds. He'd recently been suspended by Rob Manfred for instigating a brawl after he scored on a wild pitch and then stood over the catcher and yelled at him. A version of Castellanos I maintain we have never actually fully met since he's been in Philadelphia, for the record.
I want it.
Yeah, me too. But regardless, Casty being Casty, he didn't like that decision, the one that got him suspended. But any attempt to fight it would have been met, obviously, with more punishment. So in a game, he comes up to the plate and he hits a home run. And then he fist bumps a fan in the stands. And the broadcast was like, well, wonder what that's about. So they get the fan and Castellanos on TV for an interview. And they ask him, hey, why'd you fist bump that guy on the way? And the Cincinnati Inquirer wrote that the fan said, so I told Nick when he got up there that he should just imagine that Rob Manfred's face was on the baseball. And the next pitch, he lit it up over the fence. During this interview, Castellanos then crossed his arms without breaking eye contact with the camera and then shrugged after the fan explained how that had all gone.
He's like, I cannot confirm nor deny any of these facts that have been presented. I'm sorry.
So I tell you that story because it might suggest that he's not the biggest fan of Commissioner Rob Manfred, just in general, in the past. I don't know. Would he agree with that? I don't know. But there's context for their past relationship, let's say. Well, flash forward to this past week when Commissioner Rob Manfred continued to make what are apparently annual visits to each MLB team, something he's done since 2022, Hannah Kaiser writes, and he stopped by the Phillies locker room. The discussion was on labor matters as another CBA negotiation is dreadfully on the horizon. And as we know, and as Kaiser points out, Manfred has been very open in the press about his intention to sow discord in the players' union by getting to the younger players and whispering in their ears about how the older players and the union leaders don't have their best interests at heart.
Untrue.
Kaiser included this quote from Manfred that appeared in an article on The Athletic. The strategy is to get directly to the players, Manfred continued. I don't think the leadership of this union is anxious to lead the way to change. So we need to energize the workforce in order to get them familiar with or supportive of the idea that maybe change in the system could be good for everybody. But, Liz, the Phillies locker room isn't full of moon-eyed suckers open to Manfred's little plan. It's got a bunch of experienced veterans in it who've been hearing crap like that their whole careers. And one of those veterans is Nick Castellanos. So, during this meeting, apparently, things got, let's say, lively. Castellanos was the only player willing to talk about what happened in the meeting, and he said it wasn't contentious, but it was passionate and productive. He said Trey Turner had a lot of really good questions, but at one point, things got heated enough for the players to adopt an attitude that was described as, well, in that case, you can leave. Castellanos offered, unprompted, that no one was physically assaulted, which, it's going to make me consider perhaps the opposite happened.
Or but, perhaps at least one player, Castellanos, was thinking about it.
No reason to think that that's not true. It is just funny that he just offered that totally unprompted. Liz, does the union need more teams to have meetings like this with Rob Manfred? And if so, why aren't they?
I think they are. I think they will. I just don't know if a lot of players are willing to talk about it, like Nick Castellanos, who just does not, give a care for what anyone else might think, because he's in it to support the players and himself and his teammates. And he understands the business of baseball and how much he and his teammates are worth to MLB. You know, I think I do believe I read that he's going to be going to every team to have these meetings. And yes. I can only hope that there is a Castellanos on every team to sort of point out that a salary cap is a terrible idea, and you can see it in all of the other major sports leagues.
Here's my main question for all of this. It's not that, you know, oh, I can't believe that things got heated. No, I mean, I think that's appropriate.
Yeah.
Why did Nick Castellanos want to talk? For exactly the reasons you said, because he felt like it. And Nick Castellanos doesn't really do anything he doesn't feel like mm-hmm. doing. My question that I've kind of already asked a couple of times and no one else I've seen is asking nor answering. Why did Rob Manfred put his plans to sow discord in the union in the media where everyone can see it and not think everyone would know what he's trying to do or be insulted that he thinks he can do that? Like, what? Why would you be like, I'm going to puppeteer these younger players because they don't know any better, and I'm going to turn them against union leadership? Why would you say that if you didn't want people to know it? And do they not know it? And does that not weaken his plan? Why is this out there?
Because I think it's obvious what he's doing, not just with the meetings, but a few days ago, Evan Drellich reported on the, what is it, CAP. I'm trying to remember what the acronym is, what it stands for, Commissioner's Ambassadors Program, which is essentially a group of scabs, a group of former players, high profile former players who are liaisons to current and future players to travel to significant league and community events and essentially convince the players that, you know, that what Rob Manfred wants is the best. And it's once you do something like that, your plan is kind of out there, you know, because you're getting guys that these, you know, that the current players look up to. And it's a list. It is. Let's see. We've got Jimmy Rollins, Ryan Howard, and Shane Victorino. Jimmy Rollins and Ryan Howard are in leadership along with CC Sabathia. And Shane Victorino is one of the players as well.
Wow. Sabathia doesn't mess around either.
No.
You're going to hear his thoughts.
You will hear his
Castellanos style.
Exactly. And we've got Dylan Betances. I'm reading from the Evan Drellich piece on The Athletic. Michael Bourne, Prince Fielder, Dexter Fowler, Jeremy Guthrie, LaTroy Hawkins, Adam Jones, Andrew Jones, Jed Lowry, Denard Span, Nick Swisher, Justin Upton. I mean, these are all not made. I mean, yeah, there are some names.
There's some murderer's row of like vocal players.
Yeah, and that's exactly why the commissioner's office got them, because now they're not players anymore. Jim Bunning did this. The moment he was part of the hiring of Marvin Miller for the MLBPA, the nascent MLBPA, he was part of hiring him. And the moment, maybe I think it was a year or two after he retired, he was immediately on management side, encouraging the players, do not go on strike. Don't do this. And it's really gross. I'll say that. It is my least favorite thing that any former Phillies have done in a while. Because they now are on, quote, the business side. They must feel that they understand what is happening on the MLB side, to which I would like to say, no, you don't. I'm just going to say they know what Manfred has told them. And for them to not consider it from a player's view is insane. It is really short-sighted and a big betrayal, I think, too. I mean, I don't think Victorino, Rollins, and Howard were big union guys. And so in one way or another, it's not surprising. I would like to thank the Lord that Chase Utley is not on that list, because I think he's a little bit more of a union guy, and I don't think he wants to get involved in this. It's just not his nature. But one former player is I'm also reading from Drelich's piece here. AJ Pierzynski, who is also very vocal. He is on Foul, one of the hosts of Foul Territory. And he asked Dexter Fowler, my question as a former player, what side are you on?
Oh my God.
Because you work for the commissioner. And then so Rob's giving you.
Question?
Yeah, because you work for the commissioner, and then so Rob's giving you his side, but then Tony and the union has a different side. And Fowler responded, we're on baseball's side.
Oh, that's a non-answer.
And then he said, I don't think, Pierzynski replied, I understand that, but there's two sides. And Fowler said, I don't think you have to pick a side. I'm going to guess forgetting that he already has.
I will get in trouble with the one I don't say, so I will say none, is the answer.
This was a little bit more of his answer. Us going to talk to players is working with the union, right? No. We're forming basically our own opinions on what is going on. No, you're not. And giving honest feedback to Rob about the player side, even the management side. Also, no. I mean, I guess, I mean, the players will talk to you guys because you're, you know, you're big name players from the last decade, you know, decade and a half. And, you know, that's that. But, I mean, what can they tell Rob Manfred that he doesn't already know? I mean, and I think, honestly, it's a good strategy for Manfred to try and sow discord, even if he's revealing it to the world.
That's what I'm commenting on. Less so about, like, the strategy itself and more so why he's just announcing it. When it kind of, to be more effective, you'd think it would rely on being more of a clandestine operation than saying, this is what I'm going to do, like calling his shot in the paper. But I am not a negotiation expert, and what you've laid out here does make sense. And yeah, it's going to be very obvious what he would do. And it's off. It's not a tactic that is unique to this specific negotiation.
No.
Anyway, this is a very classic tactic.
It's used a lot, whether or not it's announced like Rob Manfred did. I mean, Rob Manfred's a labor specialist. This is what he did. He was in charge of MLB's side labor negotiations for years. And that's one of the reasons why the owners made him the commissioner, because he knows what he's doing. And this is a very classic tactic. What you're doing is you're setting up sort of an ideal for other players to follow, and you're setting up two sides on the union side. And that alone is going to make players feel like, well, if I go on this side, look at who I'm going to be appreciated by. Look where I might end up.
Yep.
The commissioner's definitely going to pay attention to me. And, you know, that will get me this much. Not realizing, yes, that's about you. The point of a union, the point of being a collective, is to look at the big picture, look at not just yourself, but look at the players who make more and the many players who make less. You know, they often do not have a voice. And that's what Rob Manfred is trying to do here. He's trying to pick at the players who don't have a voice and give them a chance to have a voice, quote unquote, by saying the things that Rob Manfred wants them to say, or by giving them, you know, this is, you know, baseball's opinion. You know, what do you think of that? And they'll be like, yes, I think that's great. Thank you, Rob Manfred, for taking my call or for listening to me. Like, it's all about separating individuals from the herd. And it's gross, but it works.
So I feel like it might be kind of obvious, but this little exchange that that was a little more than just a normal conversation that, you know, clearly reached at times perhaps an argumentative tone. This is a reflection of what we can look forward to when CBA negotiations take off in full force, I assume. Like, it's going to not be a pleasant process for anyone. Is that an assumption we could probably make at this point?
Oh yeah, this is gonna suck. It's all going to suck. Let everyone enjoy baseball now. Enjoy it, because we're going to get very little of it next year unless the union folds like a card table. And at this point, I don't see them doing it, because there's a lot wrapped up in this. A lot of politics from the outside wrapped up in this. And, I mean, it's going to be really, it's a minefield. of traps, and the only thing the union can do is really stand strong and try and get as many people on their side as possible. And they need to show the younger players why a salary cap is a bad idea, because as much as you think it might depress everyone's salaries, it's going to mostly depress salaries of fringe players and of younger players.
And how a union only really works the way it's supposed to when you remain unified. That is also, you know,
part of the name.
Yeah. Well, one way to enjoy baseball is to not watch when Jesus Luzardo is pitching. I'm finding last time we saw the Phillies was on Wednesday when they blew a chance to sweep the Red Sox thanks to Jesus Luzardo walking in two straight runs and allowing a grand slam. Also, JT Realmuto missing a pop-up that could have averted disaster. You're going to hear me cite both of these things in every segment of this show. Clearly, it's still living in my brain since it happened. The Phillies, you know, they fought back a bit. The game went back and forth a little bit, but they had not quite enough juice to finish the sweep of the Red Sox and ultimately lost. Liz, I don't know what the Phillies are going to do at the trade deadline. We're going to talk to Tim Jackson in a minute about that, but I'd sure like to see them stop losing games like that. Where are you on Jesus Luzardo at the moment?
He spent all of his good starts at the very beginning. I think it's difficult to watch him when he's like this because it's something that we've seen. Like, he gets frustrated on the mound and I think gets in his head a lot. And it really doesn't allow him to get out of jams that he could get out of. Now, he wasn't really helped by JT Realmuto missing a pop-up because that could have ended it all. But it's his job to, you know, if the bases are loaded, you've got to get out of that. With fewer than four runs, man, fewer than four.
Six.
Sorry, I'm just talking about at the moment when the bases are loaded, you can allow 0 to 4 runs, and he allowed 4. And that is the wrong thing to do.
If all he'd allowed was a grand slam, they would have still had the lead.
I know.
And you could chalk that up to, well, he made a bad pitch rather than two bats where he couldn't find the plate, didn't have his command, and walked in runs. Even after Realmuto came out to talk to him, that didn't really seem to do anything. And obviously, we've seen Luzardo struggle in the past this year. He is a pitcher that has looked absolutely untouched. And this is what sets it apart. It's not just like, he's a pitcher who's like good and struggles sometimes. No, it's the disparity between extremes in Jesus Luzardo and that he looks completely untouchable. As he looked very dominant in this game that we're talking about until the inning where runners got on base. It is, I hate to say, a very Aaron Nola-esque quality to look utterly dominant until something goes wrong and then things fall apart. And you don't necessarily chalk it up to like, well, he like breaks down mentally because Lizardo's saying, you know, it's not a stuff problem, according to Phillies Nation. He says, my stuff is the best it's been my whole career. It's more command, making the right pitch at the right time, executing pitches, you know, blah, blah, blah. But pitching out of the stretch right now is not working for him. And I think that's what was probably more of an issue the last time we saw him struggle in such an extreme way. They thought, oh, well, he's tipping his pitches. And again, from Phillies Nation, Luzardo was like, I'm not really sure tipping was ever a problem. So we'll have to see. It's going to be probably a little bit mental. And, you know, the Yankees, who the Phillies are about to play, are very good at picking up on what pitch is coming. So fortunately, they will not be facing Luzardo this weekend against the Yankees as the Phillies go to the Bronx. It will be Taijuan Walker versus Will Warren at 7:05 on Apple TV, Ranger Suarez versus Marcus Stroman at 1:05 on Saturday, and an ace-off with Zach Wheeler and Carlos Rodon at 1:35 on Sunday. Liz, after this series in Boston, the first series the Phillies won in 4 tries, having dropped 2 series before the All-Star break and then losing one to the Angels right after. They finally picked up a series win, blew the sweep, but got the win. Do you feel like this team looked a lot better versus Boston? Perhaps, you know, despite that bad loss in Game 3, getting back on track at the right time to play the Yankees?
I think so. I hope so. I'm really the Wednesday night loss was frustrating because the Phillies offense showed up. And they were there and they had a lead and it was a good lead. And then it was gone. And you know, with another pitcher, you know, you don't know how it might go, but you know, you think that maybe with a different pitcher they would have won that game if Luzardo, or if one thing had gone differently, maybe one little thing. But it looks like they're figuring things out. You know, Bryce Harper, dare I say, he looks like he's back.
Harper's on fire.
Oh man,
Harper's playing at like an MVP level right now. Him and Schwarber both. They are very much the beating hearts of this offense. And it's in Harper's case, it's great to see him, yes, return to form. And you just need to see some more action out there. Need to see some more hard contact, solid contact, runners on base. You know, the same problems we've complained about over the year. Got to hit with runners on base. Got to hit with the bases loaded. You gotta be able to score more than once a game. You know, you got to have be capable of more than one big inning a game. But these are all very big ideas that come together with small adjustments. So hopefully the Phillies can continue making the adjustments they need to make to win some games, because it's going to be a tough series in New York this weekend. The trade deadline. That magical time of year when everybody forgets how trades work. Until July 31st at 6 p.m., contending teams will wheel and deal until all of their problems are fixed. Or at least they claim that they are. The Phillies, as we all know, are on the lookout for relief pitching and, gosh, hopefully a bat of some kind, preferably right-handed, who can play in the outfield. Over at Baseball Prospectus, there's an ongoing series called Deadline Dreaming, in which teams' current states and potential futures are examined. Our friend Tim Jackson recently published the Phillies chapter of that series. Tim, thanks for joining us on Hittin' Season.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Tim, on Wednesday this week, the Phillies were cruising to a 5-0 win over the Red Sox, a win that would complete a sweep. Despite Boston being very good at hitting lefties, Zach Wheeler delivered in Game 1, Chris Sanchez torched them in Game 2, and Jesus Luzardo walked in two straight runs and gave up a grand slam to ruin Game 3. The Red Sox were helped along the way by JT Realmuto failing to catch or even see a pop-up that would have prevented those runs from scoring. Can you tell I was mad when I wrote this question? Then there was some back and forth, but the Phillies fell short ultimately, so I hated that. Tim, what can this team do at the trade deadline to prevent that from ever happening again?
Well, that specifically seems very hyper-Philly, so I have nothing for you on that.
nuts! I was afraid of that.
Yeah, as for the rest of the roster, I think there are a few different directions in which they can go. I think you hinted at it with saying a bat of some sort, an arm of some sort. I think what they really need is these kind of leverage guys who can amplify what they already are, what they have been, what they've grown into the last few years.
Yeah, I joke, but it does feel like this team cost itself a lot of wins for being a first place team. They could be a much better first place team. In the month of June, the Phillies' starting rotation had the lowest ERA in baseball, induced the most soft contact in baseball, had the lowest batting average against in the National League. They had the third highest K per nine in the National League, the lowest walks per nine in Major League Baseball, the best strikeout to walk ratio in baseball. I could go on. But their record in June, 14-13, one game over 500. That just feels like a lot of wasted elite level pitching. Is there a move or an adjustment, or maybe like a dream they could have that could solve that problem?
Well, I think it's twofold, right? I think it's both those things. They're going to need that reliever who can kind of keep things in check at the end of the game and kind of is maybe not even that generous given how some of the bullpen has gone this year. Like, if you look at that bullpen, who do you feel good about? Do you feel good when Tanner Banks comes in on a regular basis in a leverage moment?
Absolutely not. And coming off 2 years of like really good Phillies bullpens, which, you know, felt alien enough, you're also just waiting for like, okay, when's this going to end? Because it never lasts. And now we're here and we're down to nobody comes in that makes me feel comfortable. To answer your question, nobody makes me feel good. Maybe Orion Kirkering sometimes, but for the most part, it just feels shaky and unreliable. And I'm not even really trusting Rob Thompson's usage sometimes either.
No, it's all very, very up in the air to me. Like, specifically, I don't want to rag on Banks. You were right to say, like, maybe sometimes with some of them at certain moments. But Banks looks like high-effort Ranger Suarez, and that's, like, an extremely unfun player type to kind of get into. So when it gets to the relief market, I think David Robertson was a nice start. But it's like, if you're waiting on David Robertson to save your bullpen, to become your anchor, you're in a ton of trouble. everybody knows you can't really get excited about Jose Alvarado joining the team because everybody knows this team is really just waiting to play in October. Not waiting, but trying to make it there enthusiastically, not just one game above 500 as they are putting up some elite performances through their pitching staff with the starters. There are really interesting relievers. I think Gabe Spire is a fascinating one out in Seattle. I think Adrian Morejon would be a good one. Robert Suarez, really, really sharp. Like, it really depends on how weird the Padres get at that point, too. David Bednar, super big bounce back season. Might not excite a lot of people, but then might feel good. Like, what if Carlos Estevez last year was what David Bednar is this year? Maybe a different story.
Yeah, and Felix Bautista, the Orioles, he just went on the injured list, I believe. So he's coming off some boards. The Rays said they weren't particularly interested in trading Pete Fairbanks, who was a name. I mean, I just like his fastball. Everybody likes his fastball. I don't even know who I would say is my favorite out there, but I want to feel better about the Phillies bullpen. Do you think, like, this? Obviously they need bullpen arms, good ones, established ones, like the ones we're talking about. And as we just said, they've started to address the issue by signing 40-year-old two-time former Philly David Robertson. The Phillies are said to be looking for long-term solutions, not just rentals who will be free agents at season's end. But Tim, do you think the Phillies will be going for quantity of relief help or quality? Like, obviously the dream is quantity of quality, but I don't know if that's realistic.
I don't know that it is either, and I think that that's something that can change quickly. I don't know if you want to plan super long-term on a bullpen arm, but I think that those kinds of statements from the team shows an awareness of, like, we can't really just settle on a rental this time around. And the market is so weird this time around too, this year, that the players they have to trade, the Aiden Millers, the Crawfords, you need some sort of long-term interest back. You can't give those kinds up for rentals and survive too much in the long term. So I think it shows some long-term vision and some awareness. Whether or not the market cooperates, I don't know. that's going to be really, really tedious. I think teams are waiting longer and longer to sell. So I wish I felt better about getting someone better. But I think they know they need really that. I'm struggling to find these words.
Yeah,
they know what
yeah.
they need, right? Like, yeah. That's clear. It's not like last year where they're going to be like, well, we had this really great game pitched by one guy who popped up who's no longer in the system. I didn't think we needed anybody. I don't think they're going to pull that this year.
That's the situation, honestly. I mean, it's kind of a tough time to talk about this because everybody knows what the Phillies need. They know what they need. And, like, what they're willing to do is based on some factors that are being determined in rooms we're not in. So, like, okay, well, I guess we'll just see what happens. And I know the David Robertson signing kind of ticked people off a little bit because they get it in their heads that, like, that's the only thing the Phillies are going to do. It can't be. If that was the only thing the Phillies did, then they wouldn't be taking themselves seriously as contenders, frankly. So I don't think that's going to be the case. So I do feel strongly that they're going to make a big attempt to improve the bullpen, but they could also use that power hitting bat I was talking about. It happens to be a season where slugging numbers are just down all across baseball, so they're kind of looking for a unicorn. Maybe just generating some offense would be, you know, that'd be a boon. But my colleague John Stolness is unconvinced that they'll even necessarily jump into the outfielder market. Dave Dombrowski had that quote in Matt Gelb's recent story in The Athletic where he was like, hey, yeah, you know, we're kind of curious about, I'm paraphrasing. He didn't start his quote by saying, hey, yeah, you know. He mentioned that if they don't sign a bat, maybe they'll just bring up Justin Crawford, which doesn't really feel like the solution that he's framing it as. How likely is it that the Phillies even make the moves we think they should make?
Well, I started with relief because I don't know that the bat is going to be available. I think they actually hinted at it last year. If you think of, like, I'm a big year-over-year person when I look at any sort of trend, that's just the best way it fits in my brain. So if you look at their language last year where they're like, well, the guys that we have aren't guys we wanted to give up for these kinds of pieces. Now they're saying we need longer-term pieces, which I think does imply they're willing to move them. And I think that would be easier to do for a relief ace. Like in the piece I wrote for BP, I ran out of space to add the names, which is maybe an underrated aspect of this market, both for relievers and hitters. if teams decide to get creative enough, which I don't think is all that outlandish. There are more options than we might be realizing. So while relief might be easier, I think the bat could be both more exciting and more reliable. I would put that at a much lesser chance of happening, unless it's like kind of that mid-level, mid-range type, like Taylor Ward, who is available, I would presume, unless the Angels want to stay the Angels forever, which is a distinct possibility.
It's very possible.
But, well, you know, he's got, what, this year and next year for team control. So maybe mm-hmm. they're thinking, well, oh, what if we get a piece in that we can operate with for a couple years after that? And they start to do these value propositions in their own room. Maybe that would be the kind of move. That's like the most middle ground slash exciting option I think they have.
The most like tepid opposite of crowd pleasing move they could make. That's not necessarily a bad one. Like you throw in a 25 home run guy who's hitting like 250. You're like, okay. But then again, isn't that just like Nick Castellanos? You know, like at the end of the day, people are going to look at those numbers having never like heard of Taylor Ward and be like, this is what we're doing. And like, that's going to generally be the reaction until, you know, hopefully somebody like that comes here and starts hitting. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, with numbers and Dave Dombrowski just kind of, he seems to want to take care of business swiftly. He doesn't like to, based on what we've seen since he's come to Philadelphia, he doesn't really like to get cute. You know what I mean? He doesn't like to wait till the last minute. When he wants to do something, he kind of does it. So I guess I'm asking, do you think by like 5 o'clock on July 31st, are the Phillies done, or are they going to be like in it with everybody with like clock ticking and all the tweets flying and Ken Rosenthal's thumbs breaking off as he's sending out stuff? Like, are they going to be involved in that, or do you think things get pretty settled for them by then?
I think that is something to consider in the context of this year, where they understand what they need to do, and they also understand that probably is going to require stepping outside of the way they have normally operated in the last few years. Even like a Taylor Ward type who could become an anonymous guy you just don't remember 5-10 years from now. Yeah, I think he would offer more than a Castellanos at this point, because right now Castellanos has just been an empty batting average, which if nobody else is hitting behind him, isn't all that useful because he's just sitting out there on the bases. Like, you can't, Bryson Stott's not doing anything, Marsh is hit or miss. You have these options behind him that they've come up, they've either peaked and then set back down and haven't really rebounded. So I think that underscores their urgency. That's kind of the word I am coming back to, urgency. And so if they are making these moves, I think, are they done at 5 on the 31st? I wouldn't guarantee it. I wouldn't be surprised at all if they were like, wait, yeah, Schwarber wants to stay here, but he's only guaranteed so much longer, so many more games. And every game in October is basically a bonus with him here. And we've seen Harper have health issues again and again. We know Wheeler wants to be done at the end of this deal, and he's getting older, and he's been the anti-pitcher in that regard, but pitchers are still weird, and they still get worse as they get older anyway. I think they understand all these things, and I think they could be in the fray longer, and I think what would be extra frustrating is they don't leak. So we might not even know. We might think they're done at 5 o'clock on July 31st, only to wake up and see something very different.
Sidebar. I'm kind of over the Nick Castellanos hit a home run. So, last night with, you know, let's just call it everything that's going on right now. When he hit one, it was funny that I saw less of people going like, oh man, Castellanos hit a home run. Like, what's going to happen? And more just kind of like people shifting in their seats going like, okay, now what does this mean? Like, what exactly
what side is this falling on?
Yeah. All right. Well, let me run through. I want to list 6 different scenarios for you, one at a time. And I guess when I ask you to tell me how likely you think they are, let's do a 1 to 10 scale. 1 being not likely, 0 being not going to happen, and 10 being almost assuredly this is going to happen. So these are some scenarios that could result from moves the Phillies make or adjustments they make to their roster ahead of the trade deadline. First one is Bryce Harper goes back to the outfield.
Oh, God. Like 1.5.
You know, I'll say again that his open willingness to do so kind of ticked me off, because they acted like oh, he can't play in the outfield anymore because of his elbow. So he's got to play first, which is why Rhys Hoskins can't leave or can leave. And then they said, and then he said, oh, yeah, well, for the right first baseman, I'd go back out there. And you're like, excuse me, excuse me. What does that mean? But regardless, okay, fine. Next scenario, Bryson Stott, Brandon Marsh, or Nick Castellanos are traded.
Oh, I was very curious until the very last word there. I think Marsh and Stott are distinct possibilities at this point. As like maybe somebody sees them as a reset option. Castellanos, I don't think anybody wants to take that on, and I don't think the Phillies want to eat what it would take money wise to make it happen. I'm gonna go perfectly in the middle hedge and say five.
And if I had included Castellanos, how high would that number get?
Maybe 6.5.
Okay. Max Kepler is no longer on the team after July 31st.
Ooh. I'm going to say everybody wants it to be like 8, but yes. I think it's more like a 4.
I'm honestly at the point where it's a 10. I'm not that I think it's going to be a 10, but my want is a 10. Like right. I was in his corner, man. I really was. I was like, hey, this is, you know, sure, I can find some statistical stuff and throw it out there and say, this indicates maybe a bounce back is possible, whatever. Like, it's, why shouldn't it be possible? You know, he had a couple of, well, one really great and then some signs that he could be still pretty good times with Minnesota. And, you know, why not? Why shouldn't it work? And then it just didn't. And I was willing to just kind of ignore that. And then he was like, well, I want more playing time. And I was like, hey, man, you gotta look at those numbers. We all see the numbers, man.
Yeah.
You know, that's not more playing time numbers. That's less playing time numbers. So
yeah,
let's dial that back.
I said Castellanos has kind of an empty batting average while he's doing, I guess, mostly what he's been doing for a while. But if maybe feels that way because of the state of the team, but Max Kepler has a non-existent batting average. If you're hitting like 210 at that point, when you're willing to make these comments, it's like, ugh, Max, buddy, I have to show you something.
You have to show us something is what I feel.
Yeah. Yeah, and you're just showing him himself playing all year, and he's like, oh, it's like that? Yeah.
Oh, man. All right, next scenario. Andrew Painter does join the rotation.
I mean, this is so annoying because this is where they're like being super coy.
It's very annoying. Yes.
And like I'd said recently in a different piece that they're getting very close to the ish part of July ish, mm-hmm. which Thompson said in what, like May when he was starting to really ramp up.
And Dombrowski left the door cracked for them to walk back the he will not be coming out of the bullpen thing. He didn't say like, oh, maybe. He just was like, you never know. He threw that in to an answer about whether he would be in the bullpen.
Yeah, so I think this really gets at like both they have more awareness and more questions this year, which is really, really troubling maybe for us as the experience goes with watching them, but probably for them too in trying to suss it all out. Like, do you want to just ride it out with Walker as your fifth guy because why not? It doesn't really matter. You're going to get to the postseason. Or do you want to say like, no, we want to win this freaking division again. And every game is going to matter because it's going to be super tight. It seems all the way down. I'm going to say yes, he's in the rotation at some point. I'll put it at 7.
Safe.
Yeah. Well, that you heard my voice go up at the end, like 7. So I'm not super confident that it's that much of a lock, but I don't know why you wouldn't at this point. I also, that's maybe like a philosophical thing. I think way too many teams are way too soft with like, well, we don't want to throw a guy in the heat of a moment. It's like, well, maybe you do. Maybe you want to just see what happens.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, well, that's kind of what they're talking about with, I feel, Justin Crawford, which is our next scenario. Justin Crawford gets promoted and joins the outfield.
I think this is way more likely than I want it to be.
Oh, wow.
I think it's going to be like, so here's my worry. They can't get the outfielder they want. They do some sort of weird platoon with Kepler and Crawford or Marsh. I'm going to say it's like an 8, but I'm just not excited about him as a prospect. Maybe that's my own bias and hating on that profile, but I think that's one people are just vastly overestimating.
I mean, the trick is Crawford, you know, there's people who like him and people who are down on him. I think we all know the profile at this point. Fast guy, a lot of ground balls. But the long and short of it is the guy the Phillies need in the outfield isn't Justin Crawford right now. You know, I'm not saying he's never going to be he's not a valuable prospect or a good player or anything like that. It's just that that's not the guy that the profile of the outfielder the Phillies are looking for is. He's just not that guy. So, you know, maybe it's a scenario where the Phillies, they miss out on an outfielder that they want and they promote Justin Crawford and he comes up and he plays really well and the season is saved. Hooray. But like, that's not based on their description and of what the outfielder is that they need. It's not Crawford. It's not a Crawford type. So
it's not. And if you're going to go that way, why not? Like, I think maybe even talking him up in terms of, oh, well, maybe we'll just bring up Crawford. Maybe that's to say to other teams and try to get them to back off prices a little bit and saying, well, they really believe in Crawford. Like, maybe they aren't going to give us everything. But if you want that type, why not really push for, like, a Stephen Kwan, even if Cleveland is reluctant at first?
Stephen Kwan, I think, is my fantasy. Yeah. Honestly, the more I'm just like, oh boy, that checks a lot of boxes. Oh boy. Well, regardless, yeah. I mean, you did also just make me think that I always forget that, yeah, maybe these executives are just lying as part of a strategy. Like, that could also be there.
They would never.
All right, last scenario. Give us did you give us a number for Crawford? I can't remember.
I think I said 8.
8. Oh, you did. That's right. All right. Last scenario. Otto Kemp is named NLCS MVP.
God.
Go ahead and say a number higher than 0 if you want to.
I was going to say like 2, honestly. Ooh. Like talking myself down from something higher. Just because, like, what if he starts to catch fastballs? Like, he can't hit big velocity. That's kind of been the theme even when he was raking in the minors. But what if he just does it for a week?
Why not?
Like, he's Otto Kemp. He's not going to hit this. And then he just keeps hitting home runs. And then he's like, I'm Otto Kemp.
I hope he does scream that as he's circling the bases every time. Like, nonstop until he touches home plate again. That would be fantastic. A non-zero chance was all I was looking for. So that's fantastic news. We've been talking to Tim Jackson, staff writer at Baseball Prospectus. You can follow him on Blue Sky at Tim Jackson Says. Tim, thanks for joining us on Hitting Season.
Thank you so much. I hope we don't pull our hair out August 1st.
Over the last few months, a lot of baseball's best teams, the Dodgers, the Tigers, the Mets, Phillies, Giants, Padres, and Yankees, have had stretches of poor play. At 56-46, the Phillies' weekend opponents, the Yankees, are behind the Toronto Blue Jays in the AL East and haven't had the best last couple of days playing against Toronto. They committed 12 errors in 10 games against the Blue Jays, including 3 on Wednesday night. But they are still in the top AL wildcard spot, despite defensive struggles in a couple of spots and a thinned-out pitching staff. GM Brian Cashman says he's on the lookout for starters, relievers, maybe an infielder. Anyone the Yankees grab before the trade deadline will be joining a team that hasn't been knocking a lot of line drives, but has been doing some of the hardest hitting in the sport with Aaron Judge, Giancarlo Stanton, Paul Goldschmidt, Jazz Chisholm, Cody Bellinger. On the pitching side, they're supposed to get last year's AL Rookie of the Year, Luis Heel, back, but remain without pitchers Garrett Cole and Clark Schmidt. In the broadest sense, they aren't totally unlike the Phillies, clear contenders with perhaps even clearer issues that need to be addressed. Joining us now is Andrew Mearns, the site manager of Pinstripe Alley and a writer for Baseball Prospectus. Andrew, thanks for joining us on Hitting Season.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So it's been a rocky couple of weeks for the Yankees, which has led to one of the most entertaining things in sports. Fans of a good team having meltdowns. What I'd like to do is read you a few posts, some from Blue Sky, some are from Pinstripe Alley comment sections, and just let you respond to them, letting us know if these people are way off base, or if you totally agree with them, or if they've just gone completely feral at this point.
There's definitely some variety of all that in there, I have no doubt.
All right, well, this first one is from Blue Sky. Somebody said, in regards to the Yankees offense, haven't had a good hitting season from third base since 2020. Haven't had one from shortstop since 2019. Haven't had a good one from catcher since 2017 or 2019. This is the first year they've gotten one from left field since 2017. First good hitting season from first base since 2019. Great front office they have. Would you say that the shortcomings that this person is listing are A, accurate, and B, a reflection of the front office?
I think, if I may nitpick on that, some catcher I'm not particularly worried about. I think that that's being a little harsh on Austin Wells, who was third in Rookie of the Year vote last year. And even if he hasn't had as like smashing a success as maybe people would have liked to see as a follow-up, he's still a pretty decent hitting catcher. They've gotten some contributions too from JC Ascara, who is this backup guy who was a journeyman who just popped up and ended up being a really useful backup guy. And they also have Ben Rice, who has been playing some catcher a little bit more. He was mainly a DH, filling in for Giancarlo Stan earlier in the season. He was on the team last year too and is playing some first base, but they've been weaving him in there as well. So some characterizations in there are accurate. Third base is just a disaster right now. They had DJ LeMahieu, who is not playing third base at all because he doesn't have that ability anymore. But because he did not have that ability, they were putting him at second base, where he also didn't really have that much ability. And in that case, they were shifting Jazz Chisholm over to third base, where he, you know, filled in capably late last year after they acquired him at the trade deadline, with the intention of having him play second and Gleyber Torres play third. But Gleyber Torres said, I'm not going to do that, and I'm about to free agent, so I sort of have leverage here. So they're like, fine, Jazz, you want to do it? And he's like, yeah, sure. But Jazz capably covered it some last year, but this year was not good at third base. He could still hit, for sure. But now he's back at his comfortable position at second base with DJ gone, and they've been doing this platoon of Oswald Peraza and Yorbit Bibas, neither of whom are particularly good at all. So there's a reason you're seeing the Yankees very heavily connected to Eugenio Suarez and trade rumors.
Yeah, we're going to get to Suarez in a little bit because, yeah, I think the Yankees might probably have the best shot or the greatest need there. But a third base just seems like a puzzle to a lot of people. I mean, I'm seeing like, oh, the Mets are willing to trade from their infield depth. And you're like, oh, who are you talking about? And they're like, well, not Francisco Lindor and not Pete Alonso. And you're like, and not Jeff McNeil. You're like, okay, so people that other teams want on their teams, and like, well, you know, Mark Vientos, Brett Beatty. And you're like, yeah, I don't know if those guys are super desirable out on the market, but with third base being kind of down across the board, that I guess guys like that might have some appeal, but I don't know. Not to me.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the thing too, with just a detour from the Yankees for a second, but like the Diamondbacks, even if they were like sort of in it a little bit more than they are now, I think they would almost be tempted to sell Suarez anyway, just because he's the top name on the free agent market. And as you said, there are so many teams that need a third baseman, someone's probably going to overpay for him. So yep. Might as well see what you can get out there, especially if they can get some pitching back.
Could be a good trade deadline for teams like the Diamondbacks or the Guardians, who kind of have no reason to really be aggressive with selling, so they can just sit back and let teams make their best pitch to them. So
that'll be
interesting. But yeah, I found another comment. People are dinging the Yankees front office a bit. Another person on Blue Sky said, the way this front office has managed the left side of the Yankees infield the last few years is absolutely mind-boggling. It is the catalyst for submitting my Are the Yankees Smart mailbag question, which I hesitated even writing. It was part therapy, to be honest. So I guess, having just had the discussion we had, this person is more or less in agreement that, yeah, you know, left side of the infield hasn't been great, but we can focus on the other part. Do you think Are the Yankees Smart is a question worth asking at this point?
The Yankees are smart. They sometimes think they are smarter than they are. Like, they think they sort of outfox themselves on certain ideas and trying to like get the last grasp of people like Josh Donaldson, just because they were good fairly recently. This is a couple years old grievance at this point, but because that prompt sort of went back a couple years with third base, and with shortstop, really thought that Volpe, and they do still think, clearly, that Anthony Volpe is the answer for the future. And it's been a very frustrating couple years with him. He was a top prospect. And the funny thing is that he was a top shortstop prospect expected to be a main contributor with the bat more so than the glove. They actually had Peraza, who I mentioned before, as a better defensive shortstop in their evaluations. But in his rookie year in 23 and then his sophomore year last year, Volpe was a terrific defensive shortstop and beat all expectations. But
won
the
a gold
bat
glove.
Was falling short. Yeah, he won a gold glove. And he could have won a gold glove last year, too, but Bobby Witt Jr. is so good and probably should have won the first year, too, honestly. But the defense has taken a step back this year. Part of it, the Yankees are not pinning this on that at all, but he did tweak his shoulder a couple months back, and they're being very stubborn about, like, oh, no, he's fine. But he's, like, walking around with a wrap on his shoulder, and he's making more bad throws than normal. So I think that has to be part of it. But his range has gone down too, and when your bat is still like utterly whatever, that's not adding up to a good recipe for Yankees fans, you know.
Yeah, and looking at his Gold Glove season, when he finished the year with 17 errors, he's got 13 already this year. When you talk about a step back defensively, and that leads all of baseball. So yeah, it's definitely tough times for Volpe at shortstop. Now, down in the Pinstripe Alley comment section, I found a couple of gems as well. Somebody said, why can't any of our pitchers brush their hitters back? So tired of Springer, Vladdy, and now Addison Barger's act. Winning is the best revenge, yes, but we could do it with a bit more cheese. Andrew, do the Yankees, do they need more cheese?
I don't think we need more cheese, exactly, like protecting the plate. I think we are past the era of Roger Clemens and guys like that doing things that maybe will end up injuring someone and not end up being worth it. I don't think we need to go back to the days of Clemens giving Piazza a concussion just because he homered off of him. So.
Yeah, I don't know if more base runners was the answer for the Yankees against the Blue Jays.
Yeah, I can't say that would necessarily help. I think you just got to pitch them a little bit better and actually make the plays behind you. The defense really let the Yankees down a lot in that series with the men on the mound, who, like, they didn't pitch terrific, but probably would have had a better fate had the defense behind them actually made the plays, you know?
Yeah. Well, sticking with the Blue Jays, that brought out a lot of frustration, and rightly so, from the Yankees fan base. I can't even imagine what a series like that would have done to for Phillies fans. I mean, I've seen it happen, so I know exactly how these people feel. But somebody said, I'm going to keep pushing my conspiracy that once a cheater, always a cheater, has got these Blue Jays on some kind of Astros-esque system. They foul off too many pitches, and their proficiency at home is staggering. Andrew, are you prepared to pin the Yankees' lack of success against the Blue Jays to some sort of Astros-esque cheating system?
Would have been weird for them to wait until now to deploy George Springer's abilities with this, when they've had him on the team, I think, since 2020, 2021. And only now we're going to bring out the cheating. Only now!
We have a button where we're going to wait to press it. Yeah. Until the Yankees come to town.
A guy in the hotel rooms overseeing the field with a huge camera, which I think may have been a conspiracy theory back in the 90s, too, honestly, if I remember correctly. But yeah.
I wanted to bring this up as well, because this is an ongoing narrative within the Yankees circles. But somebody on Blue Sky said, I'm screaming once again, the Yankees will never be strong baseball team under Aaron Boone. And the narrative I'm referring to is Aaron Boone is a very player-first manager, to the point that he has been criticized in the past for maybe being a little too player-friendly. You know, he gets in interviews, he maybe says things that are glossing over what are clear issues. You know, he's very, very soft on the criticisms that come in from outside parties. That doesn't mean, you know, I don't know what's happening in the locker room, in the manager's office, you know, but in general, that's a critique that he's received over the years. And we had a manager in Philadelphia named Gabe Kapler who would give answers to reporters who were like, hey, here's this very real issue that we all saw happen tonight and is the continuance of another issue that's been going on. And he would give you an answer that was just like a denial of reality, or that like this was all part of some grand plan and they were totally in control. And it was at a certain point, like, can you please just address reality. Like, don't make us, don't say that we're crazy for noticing what's happening on the field. Now, is anything like that, do you think, happening with Aaron Boone? Do you overall approve of his managerial style? Is he too player friendly?
I think he goes a little bit too overboard in protecting his players. Yes, I think there is a legitimate argument. If you are the Yankees manager or the Mets manager or the Phillies manager or any manager in like a big market, maybe it's best to just always throw yourself in front of the players in post-game comments in media sessions, because you'd rather have the attention be on you rather than on the players themselves. And the players are just always going to receive heat, so maybe you should just always be the one jumping in front of the bus. But the degree that Boone goes to never really criticize his players is exceedingly frustrating. And it touches on some of what you were saying about being presented with specific examples of like, okay, why are you being so sloppy on defense? Why has this not changed since you were hired in 2018? This is going back a really long time at this point. But the fundamentals on the Yankees have just never really been there, honestly, under Boone. And some of that is the personnel, but also when he's the connective tissue, I guess him and Aaron Judge, but like, I know Judge is the captain, but I don't think he's the one being like, all right, we're doing drills. So, but like when that's the connective tissue and it just keeps happening over and over again, obviously game 5 of the World Series last year was the showcase for that. And had some unlikely contributors in that regard, because like when does Judge drop fly balls and like the weird covering first thing. But even still, like these outliers keep happening over and over so much that they're not really outliers. And Boone just continues like, no, we are a very good defensive team. Like he said that last night. And ooh, like,
yeah, people aren't going to like that.
happening over and over again. And I apparently just the Toronto, they've been having problems with the turf there or something like that. And Boone was like also trying not to like blame it on the turf, but he did cite the turf, which is not nothing, but also, you know, you have to get used to playing again in Toronto. You play them a ton every year and it shouldn't just be a problem now. So just a lot of frustrating things like that. Some bad base running too. That also seems to happen a lot under Boone. So you can see why that would really wear thin on Yankees fans. And I can definitely sympathize with being like, okay, how much more of this guy do we need to see?
Yeah, at a certain point, some of these answers, they could just be on flashcards. Your team's struggling defensively. You come out there and say, yeah, we got to tighten up defensively. You know,
yeah, he basically said that last night too. Like, got to tighten up. Yep.
That's it. But then again, you know, you talked about base running. Sometimes you're just the team that's playing the Braves when Ronald Acuna uncorks the most impossible throw of all time and nails a runner at third base. So
yeah, well, and that even had bad base running too, because Bebas didn't slide. Like,
yeah, that's right.
Like,
yeah.
If he slides, then honestly, no one's even remembering that throw, which is probably good. It's good to remember that throw from the larger baseball world sense, because I'm glad that Acuna had that moment, but that moment never happens if your B-Boss just slides. Oh, yeah, yeah. Sort of like Jeremy Giambi in 2001 with the flip play.
Well, here's a quote from a story on Baseball Prospectus that I think is probably true for a lot of teams. But they wrote, even as they've largely succeeded, at no point this year have the Yankees truly felt like a powerhouse. And honestly, look, I listed those teams at the top, and you just look at the standings, even right now. Dodgers have lost, 11 of 15? The Tigers were so hot, they've lost 9 of 10. Everybody seems to have taken a turn. Every contending team has taken a turn at being, like, the worst team in baseball for, like, a two-week stretch. So I don't know if that's even a fair criticism.
Yeah, I can understand, like, looking at this team and being like, I don't think they've really played their best. And actually, like, Boone and Judge have said in postgame comments that they don't think that the Yankees have played their at their hottest just yet this year. And I would push back on that a little bit. They did get off to a pretty good start. They were 17-9 in May. They had first place in the AL East by 7 games, I think, by the end of May and early June. So even if you can poke some holes in what was going on there, they were still playing really well. And I mean, certainly as well as some of like the other teams who have also hit walls at this point in the season. And I think that's just the nature of the game. It's very rare to see a team just dominate from wire to wire. And the Yankees have hit a pretty bad skid basically since the calendar flipped to June, more accurately, maybe mid-June to this point. That's how the Blue Jays have stormed up from, they were trailing, I think, 8 games back at the end of May or beginning of June. Yep. And by the end of June, they had swept the Yankees in a 4-game series in Toronto and had zoomed into first place. So, and it's also pretty close with the Yankees right now, with the Red Sox not far behind them as well. So they're definitely feeling the heat. It's been a tough stretch, and as you can imagine, that's not going to make fans happy either.
And there's been a passing of the baton aggressively for the hottest team in baseball as well. You know, I mentioned the Dodgers and Tigers struggling. Now the Brewers have won 9 of 10, or 11 in a row at one point, and just absolutely on fire. The Astros, I want to say. No, not the Astros. The Rangers. The Rangers have won 8 of 10 all of a sudden. They're only 3 games over 500 and not really, you know, in the picture, but they're now another team that's winning more. It just seems across the board, teams are just taking turns in almost equal shares this year at that, being the hottest and being the coldest teams in baseball.
Yeah, and we saw some of that last year, too, with the Tigers selling at the deadline and then suddenly just going on a run, even though they had already traded their pitching outside of Skubal.
Yep. All right, last quote I'll read you, and this is probably the most serious one. See what happens, Yankees? Let one guy grow a beard and the baseball gods come for you. Now, that's got to hurt.
That is quite the same. I was really happy to see them finally get rid of the beard policy. It's like, what are we doing, guys? It's 2025. George Steinbrenner has been dead for 15 years. Like, it was very goofy in the first place. And, you know, if your players like enjoy wearing beards and mustaches, sure, why not? Like, we are not the military. I know George Steinbrenner was obsessed with the military, but it's just baseball, guys. Carlos Rodon is pitching better with a beard than he ever did before without one as a Yankee. So, you know what? All-star.
Well, just to circle back, I did want to ask, what is going on with the Yankees sign stealing? I don't mean that in a negative way. It's all on the level, as far as we know. But Yankees base runners on second have been, let's say, aggressive.
Not subtle.
Aggressive in their conveyance of signs to hitters at the plate. Cody Bellinger's movements have been compared to those of an inflatable tube man you'd see outside a car dealership. Things came to a head a bit against the Braves recently. Braves coach Eddie Perez yelled at Jazz Chisholm for the same thing. Perez yelled at the Yankee infielder, pointed at his own head, which Chisholm took as a warning that he was going to get beaned, so he returned fire to Perez while he was on third base, and Perez said no, he was just telling Chisholm to be smart, which, you know, you like, be smart or else we're going
to
bean you
not,
in the head.
Yeah, not the best way to signal that. Yeah,
the implication there. Yeah. But regardless, have the Yankees found an advantage here? Is this something you think they should be more careful about, or is this just part of their brand of baseball?
I mean, I think it's just normal baseball stuff. I think they could be more subtle about it, but in those specific instances, like, Cody Bellinger is not a guy who's new to the league. Jazz Chisholm's not a guy who's new to the league. I think these are just a few select examples that really stuck out. And then with the Braves coach making it a whole thing, too, that turned it into like an ESPN story. So it sticks out a little bit more just because they are the Yankees. They could maybe, I guess, be a little more subtle on some of those. But it's one of those things where sort of like apparently Giancarlo Stanton was using like a torpedo bat for all of last year and no one noticed. And then like the first weekend of the season when the Yankees hit all those home runs with the torpedo bats, then the torpedo bats became a huge story. So I think it's much ado about nothing, normal baseball stuff going on with on-the-level sign stealing of pitchers who are not, you know, guarding their their pitches enough.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I totally agree. It's everything gets amplified when the Yankees do it because they're the Yankees. That's how it goes. I am glad that the Yankees aren't scheduled to face Jesus Luzardo, partially because he's the kind of guy that walks in 2 consecutive runs and then gives up a grand slam, but also because he has been victimized by revealing what kind of pitch he's going to throw. Batters have been, you know, he had that issue where he gave up 20 earned runs in 2 games because they credited that to, he was really showing his pitches. Fortunately, the Yankees will face Taiwan Walker, Ranger Suarez, and Zach Wheeler in this series. But that could very well be an advantage they use against the Phillies because the Phillies have been victimized by teams stealing their signs in the past. Last question. Obviously, we can expect to see the Yankees address some problem areas before the trade deadline this month. One big target for them is the same big target for a couple of contenders, the guy we were talking about before, slugging third baseman Eugenio Suarez of the Diamondbacks. He'd be a rental, but that's never stopped the Yankees before. And with power down across the league, everybody with a pennant in their dreams is looking for a guy who can muscle the ball over the fence. With the Yankees so closely in the mix for Suarez, is there any concern about his drop-off in slugging numbers when he's away from Chase Field in Arizona? His slugging percentage drops about 150 points when he's anywhere but there right now.
I think it's fair to be concerned about that, and I think it's fair to be concerned about just a normal drop-off in production from one of the hottest stretches of his career, too. But also, you look at what Suarez is doing, even if you take, like, 75% of what he's been doing, that's so much more than what they've been getting out of third base and third base adjacent positionings with, like, with LeMahieu, with Peraza, with Bibas. And you gotta roll the dice on someone like that anyway. And it's not, I know that Suarez is not a left-handed hitter, but right-handed hitters can homer down the line at Yankee Stadium too. It's not terribly difficult. So I'm not too concerned about the home road splits. I think he will have a drop off at some point anyway, and I could absolutely see Yankees fans turning on him the moment he strikes out a few too many times in like close situations, because, you know, Gino Suarez strikes out. That's part of the equation with him. It's just a matter of how much he can balance that with the power that was not coming in a similar player when the Yankees got Joey Gallo a few years ago. Like, the power never really came as much with the strikeouts, but with Suarez, I have more confidence that that would translate, so...
Well, we've been talking to Andrew Mearns, the site manager of Pinstripe Alley and a writer for Baseball Prospectus. Andrew, thanks for joining us on Hitting Season.
Yep, thanks for having me.
That'll do it for this episode of Hitting Season. Thanks again to my co-host Liz Rocher and all of our guests. For more episodes of Hitting Season every week, go to billypenn.com/hittingseason or anywhere you get your podcasts. For bonus Phillies podcasts, check out the Hitting Season Patreon at patreon.com/hittingseason. Thanks for listening, and from WHYY, that's the ballgame. We'll talk to you next time on Hitting Season.